Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia all over God's green world?
Well, we bit that apple and the garden was lost, and so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found. But
don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia all over God's green world?
Well, we multiplied, we needed more. The rich got rich, the poor got sore. The fuel ran scarce, the price jumped high, and so they gave nuclear power a try. But
don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia all over God's green world?
But the nuclear plants were built in haste.
Hey, everybody, this is Harvey Sluggo Wasserman back at the beach with you for the 404th Green Grassroots Emergency Election Protection Coalition Zoom call. We have 46 people with us. It is a pleasure and an honor. We're just joined by the great Ray McClendon, the state political coordinator for the NAACP. We have a tremendous array of fabulous people here. And as usual, we're going to run through an amazing agenda. I'm going to start with the mention of a passing of a great man. We will then talk with Ray McClendon about what's going on in Georgia and North Carolina at the grassroots, and segue in with Joel Siegel from North Carolina about that. Joel is then going to discuss with us something that's not being widely discussed, which is the healthcare aspects of the major bill that's now been signed off with Joe Manchin, the once and future Build Back Better bill, but it has huge implications for the healthcare system. And Joel is the man to tell us about it. Then we're going to go into the energy aspects of this bill, talk with the great Ron Leonard and Tatanka Bricka in California. That's going to take quite a while. This is a really big, complicated bill. I will not hesitate to say that, in especially because of the inclusion of all the stuff about healthcare, that this is probably the most impactful single piece of legislation since, except for the ACA, in about 50 years. This is a really huge bill, so we're going to get to the bottom of it. We're then joined by the great Greg Coleridge from Akron, who is a major leader in the Move to Amend campaign aimed at getting rid of Citizens United and getting money, God help us, out of politics. Greg is a great, great activist, a brilliant guy, and we're really honored to have him. After that, Mike Hirsch is gonna jump in, link us into the various PDA campaigns around the country, including a successfully nominated candidate for the state Senate, I believe in the state of Washington. After that, we're gonna discuss the abortion issue and run one of the most amazing 90-second TV spots I've ever seen. It's about abortion in Texas, really, really effective. And then we'll end, as we usually do, with the latest on the January 6th disaster and the progress towards putting Donald Trump in an orange jumpsuit. I do want to say that Trump made his usual incredibly offensive and inappropriate remarks about Brittany Griner, the basketball player who's been imprisoned by the Russians, basically saying she deserved it. So we're trying to do a swap in the U.S. To get Brittany back. And I suggest that they swap Donald Trump for Brittany Griner. He would look terrific in a Russian jail cell. That's exactly where he belongs. And one for one is perfectly fine. I think the Lakers will probably throw in Russell Westbrook, but that's another story. So listen, we have 2 full hours, a wonderful, wonderful group of people to discuss all this with. We're with 54 of you. And we're gonna start with a fitting tribute to one of the truly great Americans of all time. I am from Boston. I grew up watching the Celtics when I was a kid and Bill Russell. And you know, there's always a debate about who is the greatest ball player of all time. And I will say without hesitation that no one will ever lay a greater claim to being the greatest ball player of all time in all sports than Bill Russell. Bill Russell won with the Boston Celtics 11 championships in 13 years, two of them as a coach. He was the first African-American coach in any major sport. And, you know, to win a championship as a player coach is amazing. The Celtics would have won not one of those championships without Bill Russell. No one is ever again going to win 11 championships. And so Bill, and I was reading the obits today about Bill Russell. He was an incredibly brilliant guy. And he did something that just completely blew me away. He came to the I just found this out today. He came to the 1963 March on Washington, having met Martin Luther King. And they asked him to stand on the stage. And he refused because he said, if I stand on the stage, everybody's gonna be looking at me. And I don't belong on the stage. I'm just another activist. And so, and he was 100% right. Having shown the Martin Luther King speech to 100 of my history classes when I was teaching, I guarantee if Bill Russell had been on the stage, it would have been a major distraction. I've never seen or read of a more selfless act in political activism than that from Bill Russell. So it kills me that I never met Bill Russell. I wish I had. I knew people who knew him, never heard a bad word about him. So for the greatest of all time, Bill Russell, thank you. And anybody, as we proceed, anybody wanna jump in and add to that, please do. But he was just an incredible joy to watch. I also grew up watching Jim Brown, by the way. And Bill Russell just was a magnificent human being. So we owe a lot to him, and I'm really grateful to be able to say that to all of you. Mike Hurst, do you wanna jump in on that?
Yeah, I just wanna say, I've never seen an interview with Bill Russell where he wasn't laughing and smiling. He had a great sense of humor. He was one of the most brilliant people. You could tell how intelligent he was. He's really on the next level. And he played basketball like nobody else. He knew where everything was going to happen. He knew where the shots were going to go, where the rebounds were going to go. And he, every game with him was a clinic. He wasn't always the tallest guy on the court, but he was always the best. Well, the smartest.
You're right. And he played against Will Chamberlain, who was over 7 feet. And Bill Russell, I know this is a shocker, Bill Russell was only 6'9". He was the same height as Larry Bird and Magic Johnson, both of whom, by the way, I also met. And both of them were very gentlemanlike and would have given a similar eulogy to Bill Russell, as would Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. So anyway, we were in the presence of a giant, and he will be completely missed. My God, what an incredible figure. Okay, and,
One more thing really quickly. We also lost Nichelle Nichols, who's the actress who played Uhura on Star Trek. And she was a groundbreaker in her own way. And she elevated women of color on the small screen like no one had at that point. And at one point she was thinking of quitting the show. And none other than Dr. Martin Luther King called her and said, please don't, because every week when you're on television and you're showing a future, I want to show a smart, essential African-American woman on that show. And she stayed with the show.
Yeah, and as it turns out, this I never knew, Martin Luther King was a Trekkie. He was a big follower of Star Trek. Anyway, we have another giant with us today. We're going to move ahead. Ray McClendon, We've never met personally, Ray. Are you 6'9"?
No, only in my dreams. Only in my dreams.
All right. Well, listen.
Glad to be 5'11".
You are playing power forward for the Georgia NAACP, and we would really like you, if you will, please, to update us on what's going on there. We know you're making an alliance with Joel Siegel and the grassroots campaign. I also would like you to comment, please, before we lose track, on the status of the prosecution by the Fulton County against Trump. That's a big deal. So choose your path, and we're honored to have you with us.
Okay, thank you. Well, let me talk about the suit first, because that came up a week or two ago, and there was some breaking news at the time about the judge ruling that Fannie Willis could not look into Burt Jones as a target, pursue him as a target, and question him. And that was the lead headline. Some headlines called it she was disqualified from going after him, or whatever the case may be. The bigger picture, though, is, and the reason that the Burt Jones issue came up, as many of you know, is that he's running for lieutenant governor. And Fannie Willis put on a fundraiser for Charlie Bailey, his opponent. And that gave the judge some pause. And I think rightfully so. If you look back on it, that was probably not a wise decision on her part at the time to decide to prominently put on a fundraiser for a lieutenant governor or any statewide race candidate, given the sensitivities of what she was involved in. Nevertheless, the bigger story is this. The judge gave her the right to pursue all of the other targets, including a sitting congressman, Congressman Heiss, which she will continue to be able to interview. He tried to use the federal officer provisions to eliminate him, and the judge wouldn't go for it. And as you also know, Lindsey Graham tried to use some similar language, and they all are going to have to abide by the courts in Georgia. And if there's any dispute, it would have to be dealt with by the federal district court in Atlanta. So she had a big win that was lost in the shuffle because of the one item related to Burt Jones running for lieutenant governor. Also, even with Burt Jones, the judge did not say he could not be questioned. It's just that if they want to question him, another district attorney will have to do it, and they'll have to make that decision. So all in all, it was a lot of bluster about what was going on with Burt Jones, but with all of the other target letters to the other fake electors, with all of the provisions of who has got to come before the court, before the grand jury to testify, including Lindsey Graham and Congressman Heiss, all of those things have stayed in place. So that whole process is moving forward in the courts in Atlanta, and she is firmly in control of that and is very aggressive with that. And for my money, she's still ahead of the Department of Justice, which is an embarrassment that you've got a local DA that's ahead of the Justice Department in terms of issuing target letters, bringing folks before a grand jury, and pressing Trump. So I think that is all positive, although there was that one hiccup. So that's where we are with that.
Good, great to hear it, because there was a perception that she was prevented from pursuing the prosecution of Trump, and what you're saying is that's not the case.
That's not the case at all. She's moving forward with all of the other fake electors, and they have all been confirmed as targets now. They went from just being questioned, summoned to be questioned before the grand jury, to being actual targets. So that has upped the ante dramatically in that case.
Well, and I think Georgia would be a wonderful venue for Donald to spend a few years behind bars.
But, absolutely.
Okay.
I completely concur. Completely.
Okay.
Okay, so let's look at where we are. We're now 99 days away from the election, but we're only some 70 plus days away from the actual start of early voting. So we're putting together now the same game plan that we had in 2020, but we're ramping it up to the Georgia Way 2.0 by expanding our network, both in terms of counties that we're going to go after. In 2020, we went after 19 counties that represented 77 to 80% of the Black vote. Now in 22, we've targeted 58 counties that represent 90% of all voters of color, over 90% of all voters of color. There are 159 counties in Georgia, and that's the reason we have to focus, because we got to go where the voters of color are, not over disperse our resources. And so we've done that work. So what's going on right now is that we are doing the planning with all of the Georgia Way members. And as many of you will recall, those members include the Divine Nine, which are all of the Black fraternities and sororities, the other grassroots organizations in the state, like the New Georgia Project, the Coalition for the People's Agenda, the Urban League. All of these groups came in 2019 and 2020 to be a part of the Georgia Way Coalition. And now we've added some other large groups. FaithWorks, just newly minted organization, big article in the New York Times about it a couple of weeks ago, is a coalition of 1,000 congregations around the state. So in 2020, unfortunately, the faith community was not up to par in terms of what they would normally do in an election cycle. So this is a major effort, and they've also agreed to become a part of the Team Unity / Georgia Way strategy that we have in place. So that's a big deal for us to have the faith community directly tied in with what we're doing. All of these groups have the ability to mobilize large groups of trusted messengers and volunteers in these 58 counties that we're talking about. So what we're doing now over the course of the next couple of weeks, and we're actually having a meeting tomorrow night, the key civic engagement groups that do this on a day-to-day basis statewide have formed a steering committee, and we're putting the strategic plan together as we speak. So groups like Black Voters Matter, the Divine Nine statewide coalitions themselves, the Urban League, and the NAACP, what we're doing is creating the strategy of the messaging and a 100-day game plan that we will then incorporate and push out to all of these groups. So the main thing they have to do is they don't have to worry about messaging. They don't have to worry about creating flyers and door hangers and all of that. They don't have to worry about creating text banking platforms and phone banking and all of those components. We will do all of that work for them. So the main thing they have to do is mobilize volunteers. So all of that will be coming together over the next 2 weeks. And then we will be in the street en masse beginning in the middle of August.
Now, do you have a guidebook or piece of a literature that we can put out online and provide to other grassroots campaigns around the country?
We don't have a guidebook we can put out online, but we'd be happy to share with any of the groups that are interested in that on how to lay out a plan, because our plan is going to be specific to Georgia. And so what we'll do, as an example, as Joel puts together North Carolina, we'll help and give advice on how to create a plan in North Carolina for the way they operate. As an example, we've got 58 counties here that we're going after because Georgia has 159 counties, and that's just too much to focus on. North Carolina might have fewer, and therefore they can organize a little bit differently than we do. And it depends on where the pockets of their voters of color are. So you got to customize, but the big infrastructure will be the same. So the components are all there. The faith community, the Divine Nine, the Masons, the Urban League, all of those groups are there, and they need to understand how they will be much more effective and efficient by creating one organization if they set ego to the side and do that, as opposed to everybody trying to do their own thing.
Fantastic, really fantastic. We're really honored to have you with us about that array. Joel Siegel, do you wanna jump in now and tell us how you've been working with Ray and how we're gonna segue this into North Carolina and around the country?
Yeah, I just wrote in the chat, Ray equals organizing genius. You know, what he's done in Atlanta, you know, he's many times talked about these accomplishments with the Divine Nine, but it's a lot harder to actually organize all these groups. But yeah, we're just taking the Georgia model from Ray and his colleagues, and we're going to replicate it here in Mecklenburg County and Wake County. Wake County is considered one of the 22 counties that is essential to turn North Carolina blue. But right now we've got the International Minority Coalition, that's 40 ethnic communities mobilized. We're bringing together people who've actually won elections, local, state, and congressional, and we're creating a brain trust. And then Ray will be the senior consultant, as will Andrew Miller. But that's basically what we're doing. We're just gonna take Ray's plan and do it here. And if we did this in swing states, progressives could win. But as long as the one of the dominant parties, the Democratic Party, continues to run TV ads and hires consultants and run candidates that look like, you know, lawyers or bankers or something, we're not going to win a lot of elections. But Ray, thank you for making sure that we have that model here, because we're ready to implement it. We do have to raise some money, which is always challenging, right, Ray?
Absolutely. Got to raise money and get these organizations to recognize that we can be a force multiplier 5 to 10 times over what they can get out of putting this money into a political campaign.
Yeah, the challenge is the precinct captains are always the ones. I've been doing elections for 40 years, and that was always the challenge. Is precinct captains would always say they don't have enough money to get the vote out. And but what I think we'll be able to raise it once we show we got an infrastructure, we have a plan. Then we're going to go to donors inside and outside the party, the Democratic Party. But we can, Cheryl Beasley, who's running for Senate, African-American woman, former Supreme Court justice, we're doing a town hall meeting with her in about 3 weeks. And we're going to, you know, share, we're doing this through Robert Wilson, who's you know, talked many times here. And we're going to let her know, you know, respectfully, these are the issues that we need her to run on if she wants to get ethnic communities, Black votes, and progressive whites. And this has never been done before. This is all because of the Greek call and connecting all of us. So thank you, Harvey.
Well, thank you, guys. Does anybody want to jump in with questions for Ray or Joel at this point? Yeah, what we need, we really need something that we can send around, an article or a guidebook as to the main components of the grassroots organizing. That one, you know, we have the book that you did, Ray, the Georgia Way, but we need a very, you know, 10 page or less kind of guidebook to get this duplicated around the country.
Andrea and I are working on something, so we'll get something to you in the next few days that we can send out to funders.
That would be great. Absolutely. Okay.
Dr. Ruth has her hand up.
Dr. Ruth, and then whoever.
Yeah.
Point man.
Ray, I just want to tell you, please tell. I've called her office before, but please thank Fannie Willis and tell her she is one brave lady. You know, those people in Georgia don't play. So my hat's off to her. She's wonderful, and please let her know.
Yeah, we should have. Totally, we'll do. Thank you, Ruth, for mentioning, you know, she's getting all sorts of death threats and other stuff thrown at her, like it's going on all over the country. And so we definitely want to have her back wherever we can, Ray. Okay, who is Point Man? You're our new to the call.
Yeah, I'm asking for a real name, and we'll call on them when they show up their real name, but until then.
Okay. Anybody else want to jump in here with Ray and Joel Siegel on what's going on in Georgia, North Carolina? This kind of organizing has to go on all over the country. That is the big, you know, if there's been a central theme to our cause, it's been getting the money and the energy from the Democratic Party or into the grassroots. I mean, Ray, have you had made any headway with the mainstream Democratic Party and getting to understand the value of grassroots organizing?
To use a diplomatic phrase, we're in negotiations. and hopefully I'll have more to share on that later, but it's the same argument that we've had to have with them over the years. There's gonna be a ton of money that's gonna flood in as it did for the Senate runoffs in 2020. And what these candidates have got to decide to do is to steer some of those donors directly to us, because we can't take money from their campaigns, but they need to send some of the donors our way, recognizing that 80 to 85% or more of the people that we turn out are going to be sympathetic to their campaigns. And it's a no-brainer, but they, unfortunately, we live in an environment where your cash amount in the bank is supposed to be some barometer of whether or not you can win. And that's just not the case. You can ask Jamie Harrison in South Carolina about that. You know, he raised over $100 million and lost woefully. And so we've got to get out of that notion that if Warnock outraises Herschel, he'll win. If Stacey outraises Kemp, she'll win. No, that's not the case. Virginia is, and Andrea Miller can tell you about that, Virginia being the cautionary tale, because everybody thought that McAuliffe would be a great candidate because he could raise money. They forgot to penetrate the Black communities to get the vote out, and they had alienated the Black community by letting McAuliffe, you know, jump to the head of the line over a couple of Black female candidates. And so that's why you need these grassroots organizations, because they are embedded and entrenched in these communities, and they can energize those voters. We see a trend in the direction of energizing the electorate. And that can now, because of what happened with Roe versus Wade and the elevation of reproductive justice as a key component in the race, with other components that these folks that are these grassroots trusted messengers can raise, we can get across the finish line, but it's gonna be that level of local detail. I see somebody's raised their hand.
Yeah, Ron Leonard, Ron.
So Ray, I know you're a genius because we agree with each other. And the thing that we agree upon is a troubling factor in my mind, that we're seeing statistics that show Spanish and Black Americans are starting to register for Republican voting. And I'm wondering if you really are the solution to that, both in terms of communication and in terms of getting souls to the polls, because that's what you're talking about, souls to the polls.
Absolutely. No, you're absolutely correct. So there's some reality and there's some myth in that, okay? And again, it speaks to why what we are trying to do with the Georgia Way and the NAACP is so important. Republicans are investing in relational organizing. They are investing in putting up Republican offices in Black communities. They're doing it, as you know, in Hispanic communities. And they're picking them off with targeted messaging that motivates either through fear or through some memory of why it is that you can't go Democrat. You know, why do you think it is so significant that they brand Democrats as socialists? Because many of these Hispanics are going to immediately go the other direction, because it was socialist persecution that they immigrated to the United States based upon. So that, you know, that's a dog whistle that the Republicans use in the Black community, the especially among Black males that voted maybe 15% for Trump. They are using entrepreneurship and independence and, you know, having an opportunity to be your own person and look at the idea of who Trump is as a businessman, an entrepreneur who you know, shares that common, you know, want to have all of the gold and the bling that you have. And there's an element of that ties in with rappers and wanting to be a rapper and all of that. So they can pick off 15% of the vote with that. And they are putting into the community those offices and saying, we will put some money in the street. We will have some local rappers who will buy into what we are selling, and let them be those trusted messengers to that 15%. That's why it's so important that we raise the money to be out there to counteract and offset those shallow messages, a lot of which is misinformation. But if there's nobody out there that they trust, and we're just talking about on TV or whatever in the normal cable news, what Biden is doing or not doing, you are never going to reach those folks. Never. And that's where we're failing. That's where most of the Democratic candidates are failing, because they are not investing locally year round. You can't go into people and just talk about, oh, vote for a particular candidate 60 days out. You need to be in the community supporting people year round. That's what we're trying to invest in.
And I saw that up close and personal in Florida, where basically the Republicans got in there and Trump got in there and labeled Democrats socialists. Now, exactly. A socialist to a Cuban American is really not a person he's going to vote for, but no one was out there countering the agenda.
Right. Well, let's hope that we get some better traction this time. Justin, thank you, Ron. Justin LeBlanc, and then we're going to move ahead.
You mentioned some of these places like Latin America being against socialism. So somebody mentioned Cuba communism, Castro communism, and I wanted to push back a bit and say religion is actually a big feature in those cultures. And sometimes when they come to America, religion especially can be super dogmatic, super, how should we say, reluctant culture against the cultural transformation. So I'm wondering if, as you go around to folks, if you're able to have some sort of unified message about what progressivism is, or it has to be taken on a case-by-case basis.
Well, again, I think when you break down the messaging of what we are for and what the candidates that we are supporting, what those candidates are for, if you can break down the messaging with trusted advisors to these folks, they'll say, oh, okay, great. This makes sense. I didn't know that. The problem is that the QAnon radical extreme right is so much better at messaging than progressives are. That's just a fact. And until we can get better at messaging and penetrate, we're going to be at a disadvantage. Like I said, they have taken words and put them out of context in order to provoke fear and victimization. And that's a strong emotional connection to people. And so unless somebody's getting out and directly refuting that, you are never going to get them to come across. That's why it's so crazy when you see that somebody like Trump, who hates immigrants, can get 30 to 40% of the Hispanic vote. And you say, how can that be when you listen to what he's saying about your people? And it's because they are more concerned of the trauma that they think will happen if they are supporting people that will revert to socialism. That's what is not getting fought. So we can talk about all of the normal stuff, but unless, and you can't just do that 3 months out of a year. You got to do it. See, we're out in the street. We do food distributions every Wednesday, year round. We were out doing, you know, giving away book bags in the community for back to school on Saturday. You need to be connected with people, with groups that are in the community year round. That's what we mean by trusted messengers. You can't show up, you know, and parachute in, with all due respect, some white progressives from California in October to canvas. You just can't do that. Okay, that does not work. They need to see the person that walks down the street that will tell them, son, I've known you since you were 12 years old. You know you need to get out and vote. And this is important. Not somebody that they just met for the first time.
Right on, Ray. Really beautifully said. You know, there's a thing, the relationship between Donald Trump and Lincoln. Lincoln said, you can fool some of the people all the time. And Trump said, well, those are the people that I'm looking for. So does anybody else want to say a few words to Ray? Ray, it's always an honor to have you on here. We have 64 people with you. We're going to push ahead now, again with Joel Siegel. We're looking at this. Ray, your work, by the way, is at the core of everything we do. We're promoting you and the NAACP wherever we can. We now are looking at this major bill that Joe Manchin has shocked the world by supporting. Everybody's on pins and needles waiting to hear what Kyrsten Sinema is going to say, but so far hasn't been much. But what people are not talking about this big bill in Washington is the healthcare aspects. You know, it's basically viewed as an energy bill, and we will get into that with Ron Leonard and Tatanka and everybody else in a few minutes. But this bill has an enormous impact on healthcare in our country. And we have with us the Godfather, who looks, you know, a lot like Al Pacino as a young man, Joel Siegel, who co-authored the ACA bill. And Joel, can you, I gave you a homework assignment, which you carried out. Can you tell us what is going on in this national bill with healthcare?
Sure. Thank you very much. So I wrote the bill Medicare for All, HR 676, which is the only true way to get to single payer. But on the ACA, I had written a prior bill which would expand Medicaid to all the uninsured. And I got real lucky. And they put a version of that and some of the other bills that I had written into that bill. But until we have single payer Medicare for all, we're still going to have a suck healthcare system. I don't think that's cursing. So the one thing I wanted to figure out, how come Manchin did a turnaround? What happened was there was a lot of pressure on Manchin externally in the press and by his own people in West Virginia, especially the Poor People's Campaign. But what happened really was he got a lot of pressure from other senators. And the Senate is a good old boys club, and I guess a good old gals club too. But he had several members of the Senate basically challenge him and say, look, you know, why don't you turn this around? Instead of going down as the person who destroyed civilization by not addressing climate change, how about if you go down in history as the person who saved the planet? And apparently, you know, he had a change of heart, but also there were some oil and gas pipelines and things that were going to go through West Virginia. And then once they worked that out, he said, yes. Thank you, Jeffrey Gordon. So I'll go through some of the parts of the BBB that are, I think, salient to progressives. It has not been passed. It has to be passed in the House, by the way. And they're going to try to see if they can pass it through reconciliation, which is a possibility if, you know, Sinema is on board, and it's not clear that she is or if she isn't. But Manchin did say that she was on board on public, you know, on TV stations. Normally, you don't say that for another member of Congress unless you've got good evidence about that. Otherwise, they get into bad fights. And I used to have to deal with those fights sometimes. So we might be able to, might happen. So anyway, so in terms of the healthcare provisions, and I'd say it's one of the most important provisions, is the bill empowers Medicare to negotiate prices of certain costly medications administered by doctors, but not all medications. And this is the catch. The Health and Human Services Secretary would negotiate the prices of 10 drugs in 2026 and another 15 drugs in 2027 and again in 2028. The number would rise to 20 drugs a year for 2029 and beyond. Now, what's inadequate, of course, about that is it starts in 2026. That's, you know, there are going to be a lot of people who will die or get sick because they cannot afford, you know, the cost of the drugs. But all that being said, we worked for decades to try to get Medicare to negotiate with prescription drugs. We cannot get it done. So this is a step forward. But, you know, the one thing they did take out was they wanted insulin to be no more than $35. And insulin is a killer. They did not get that passed. I don't know why, because AARP and these senior organizations are very strong groups. They could not get that done. So the legislation would also impose penalties on drug companies if they increase their prices faster than inflation, which is interesting. I've never seen that before, where the government actually punishes a drug company. Free vaccines for seniors. Medicare enrollees would be able to get all vaccines at no cost. You know, right now, only certain vaccines like COVID-19, flu, and pneumonia are free. Affordable Care Act subsidies. This is pretty important. Democrats are also looking at extending the enhanced federal premium subsidies for Obamacare coverage through 2025, a year later than lawmakers recently discussed. That way, they wouldn't expire just after the 2024 presidential election. The reason why that's important is what happens if the House and the Senate are Republican? There's a very good chance that they would not allow for those subsidies to go past their, you know, the sunset. So that's kind of cool. So the subsidies were expanded this year.
Hello?
Joel?
Joel, we lost you here.
Joel, you got to unmute. There you go.
I have no idea how that happens.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I'll just go through a few more things that probably be somewhat interesting. So the enrollees would pay no more than 8.5% of their income toward coverage, down from nearly 10%, and lower income policy holders receive subsidies that eliminate their premiums completely. Now that is very important. I was actually a critic of the ACA behind the scenes, and I kept doing briefing after briefing on single payer until we passed ACA, and even after we passed it. But even if, you know, you don't have any premiums that you have to pay, you still have to pay copays, which is what single payer eliminates, our copays. Let's see. So among those earning more than 400% of the federal poverty level, they will have become eligible for help for the first time, which is pretty important because the restrictions on eligibility for ACA are kind of tight. So this raises that. Then Democrats are hoping to avoid the negative publicity of such premium increases. If Congress doesn't act, consumers would learn in the fall just how much more they'd have to pay. Extending the enhanced subsidies would cost $64 billion, according to the CBO. So in short, Medicare will be able to negotiate some prescription drugs that are probably the most expensive to seniors. The premiums, the subsidies for the premium for private insurance will go down, you know, and then a lot of enrollees won't pay anything. They did try to have there was a provision in the bill that Manchin nixed where the states that did not expand Medicaid would have been able to purchase Obamacare and what's called the exchange private insurance. But that's pretty much it. I'll conclude by saying this is a good step forward. But if the Congress does fall into the hands of MAGA, we can forget. Yes, there could be a veto from the president. But, you know, we always have to be on guard about the elimination of the Affordable Care Act, because that's one of the main planks of the Republican Party is to eliminate any kind of public programs that expand health insurance. And they're certainly against universal health care. But that's pretty much it.
Thank you. That's probably, of all the media in the United States, that's probably the most detailed account of the healthcare aspects of this bill, which nobody is talking about. So thank you, Joel, very much. A very important addition to the dialogue, and nobody better qualified than you,
thank you, to
deliver it. Let's go down to the energy. And Greg Coleridge, you're with us. Once we get through this part, we will go to Citizens United, and then we'll have the folks from PDA that will be introduced by Mike Hirsch. We'll talk about abortion, and then we'll talk about January 6th.
Slugo, so, there's one little piece, which Joel, I think you can confirm if I'm right. There is a cap per year of $2,000, and that's a big voting issue, because if you have a fatal illness and you're going to have to buy more than $2,000 worth of drugs, let's say $500,000 worth of drugs, well, you could lose your house, you could lose everything. And if this cap is true, that you are per year stopping at $2,000, that's a voting issue.
I'm glad you brought this up. I did not see anything about that in the summaries. That doesn't mean, though, that's not in there. And
let's check it out, Ron.
I believe it is.
You raise an important point. Let's look at that next week and see if we can get to the bottom of it. And hopefully we'll still have a bill and Kyrsten Sinema will get her pound of flesh, and hopefully we'll still have legislation next week. Okay. Although I will say, segueing into the energy part, that a lot of the environmental groups are very, very unhappy about the the federal leasing that's involved here. But Ron Leonard, as a leading expert in the solar industry, and then we'll bring a Tatanka Brick into this, it seems that this is manna from heaven for the solar industry. So can you talk to us about that?
So I think we should talk to the issue based on history. And the history this year is that 55% of the large solar projects in the United States are postponed. Why? Because of import duties, because of the increasing cost of solar panels, because. But this bill cleans up one big issue, and the issue is tax credits. And tax credits were basically declining 10% every year. And this bill proposes that the tax credits are set at 30%. That's the investment tax credit for buying a solar panel. And that continues year in, year out, year in, year out for a few years. This stabilizes everything. This enables money to move into the marketplace. That shows that this is a rational investment. And once you can see a rational investment, this is also a safe investment. So where else are you going to put your money? Real estate, stock market? I don't know. And this does make a case, an economic case, for the fact that solar, wind, hydro, other things are the cheapest investment that America can put into place to save people going bankrupt paying their utility bills. That's a big deal for people. That's a vote issue. So if you go down the list of stuff in the top line estimates, there is $385 billion for clean manufacturing credits, clean energy grants and loans, $40 billion, clean energy technology, $30 billion, clean agricultural funding, another $30 billion, clean vehicle credits. You go out and buy a Tesla this year, you don't get a credit. If you go out and buy a Tesla next year, you'll probably get a $4,000 credit. And lastly, renewable energy credits, $235 billion. This really does save an industry that was faced with an awful future.
Fantastic. And I will say one thing, my son-in-law and daughter have bought a building in Hackensack, and we are going to create there the probably the country's first solar-powered music and video studio. And it will, in fact, be hugely impacted by the federal tax credit.
Absolutely.
A 30% federal tax credit is a very big deal. So there you go. Joel, did you have your hand up here? Joel Siegel? No, okay, so.
Let me bring one more thing, which is that we are faced with 90% of these solar panels coming from someplace else than the United States, mostly China. This bill puts in a manufacturing credit for through 2029 that shows that people can start manufacturing the technology that we developed here in 1951, solar panels, solar cells, we developed it. And in 2009, China took over the marketplace and started producing more than we did. The production of solar panels can and will move back into the United States.
Well, from your lips to God's ears, as they say, we have 72 people on the call. Tatanka Bricka, I want to segue over to you. I think Joel doesn't know his hand is up, but if you want to raise it again. Oh, we have Myra Reason. Myra, one of the great safe energy activists in Santa Monica. Myra?
Hi, I just unmuted. I am wondering, as recently as last Thursday, I heard something repeated that I have heard from people who are on the left. Advocating for nuclear power, saying that we simply can't ramp up enough electricity with the use of solar and wind and renewables to meet the electrical needs, the needs for electricity for our people. How do we respond to that?
That's an absolute false flag, and we can prove that. Dr. Richard Perez and his son, Mark Perez, have done multiple grid studies of actual grids like the Mid-Continent ISO on how to produce 100% renewable energy on a grid cheaper than you could possibly do that with fossil fuel. This is hard science, peer reviewed, can be done, should be done, will be done. And when we see the cost of various forms of energy, you will note that invariably nuclear energy is the highest cost of producing energy. And minor little difficulties, renewable energy, like in Texas when we just had the heat wave. Well, those nuclear power plants actually had to be shut down in Texas because they have this thing called a cooling tower. And it really doesn't work very well, if at all, at 100 degrees Fahrenheit. So facts are important. And when we see an industry that's being propped up by, for whatever reason, either large nuclear plants or these mini nuclear plants that they're proposing to put in, one of them has been approved just this week, that's a fool's errand. That's a bargain with the devil.
Right. Let's put it very clearly, Mama. You're well aware of these things. The small reactors they're talking about can't come online until 2029 or 30, and we call them Putin mini bombs. Every mm-hmm. one of them will be very, very vulnerable to terrorism. The 400 reactors worldwide in the United States, the 92 that we have are an average age of 39 years old. You cannot have a blanket discussion about nuclear power. It's all about each individual reactor, like the two in California that will blow up when the San Andreas goes off and send a radioactive cloud into LA County. And so the existing fleet of commercial atomic reactors in the United States and worldwide, each reactor has to be evaluated individually. None of them have insurance policies, and none of them can compete with wind or solar. And since you mentioned Texas, I love to say this, but when the nuclear industry got started, they promised energy too cheap to meter. And in Texas, we now have West Texas, we now have wind power, which is in fact too cheap to meter, and they give it away at night. So, you know, wind and solar are 100% the way to go. Tatanka Bricka, you in California are continuing to push the Green New Deal. Where do we stand with the attack on rooftop and the pushing of the Green New Deal in California?
Well, as I think we get the, as Ron was talking about, the economics of wind and solar have far bypassed nuclear and will continue to do so. Their whole argument is based on basically trying to eliminate a marketplace technology, among other things, and then spread lies. So for instance, in order for PG&E to access a pile of this $6 billion that shows up in the Biden bill going to nuclear, they had to send messages to change the wording of the contract, which has always had, you have to supply a cost comparison of nuclear to the alternatives. They've gotten rid of that. They eliminated that because they know it's vastly more expensive, and they're going to be asked, what is it going to take to clean up Diablo Canyon? What is it going to take in the future? What are the risks of all these canisters sitting around, you know, with material, et cetera? They want to avoid all that. So the only way they can make an argument that, and here we are in California, just entering probably another 90 to 120 days of chief fire season. It's going into November these years, and the fires are raging. Their fear argument is there's going to be 3.5 Californians that are going to be without power from most of the afternoon and evening during the height of fire season, unable to turn on an HV when it's 110 in the valley, et cetera. All that is based on suppressing solar, suppressing wind, and opening the floodgates to something that, as Harvey says, isn't even going to be, you know, it's a terrible idea, but it's not even going to be online for years. So they are just desperate to stop and not have to look at decommissioning Diablo Canyon, which is the model for how all nuclear power should be decommissioned. So I think as the word gets out, 80% of people in California, crossing all political barriers, I don't care if you're a libertarian or a Republican or a Democrat, people want their solar power. It's not difficult to understand. My roof gives me solar power. And for decades now, when we use our excess, the state credits them back money. Now the PUC wants to stop the credit back. It's very clear that they're trying. And what was really funny is the amount of money that they wanted to get back in a single year was the exact amount that it would take to start doing what they were supposed to do years ago, which is put their electrical lines underground because of the fire danger. So they're looking for money to do what they're supposed to be doing, and they're trying to tax the most effective way of electrifying California, which is solar. So yeah. I don't think they're gonna win it, but it is going to take, you know, it's gonna take legal action as well as a lot of people mobilizing like we've been doing, like the meetings that have had, you know, that have postponed many decisions. So that's where we're at.
And right. My good friend Carl Lavago did a study of California and showed the exact dollar figure that solar on roofs gives to every ratepayer in the entire state. It's an amazing number. Take a look at it.
Yeah. And so, of course, they know that's true. And they so what they do is they tell the lie that these people are actually making life more expensive for you when the truth is the exact opposite.
Exactly. We have Ray Lutz from Southern California.
Hey.
Ray has been instrumental in both the election protection and the an anti-nuclear movement, and was instrumental in helping shut San Onofre. Ray, what you got for us?
Well, yes, I have to say, you guys are right.
Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.